The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 179.ex3937, certificate number 31484, Candlestick Park.
But a big league town needs a big league ballpark. And so, quick as a wink, or maybe two, up went beautiful Candlestick Park.
Hi, Grant.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. Welcome on the Omnibus, or welcome to the Omnibus.
It is it's a great honor. I've been a long-time listener.
You're not on the Omnibus yet because you have to do a good show. If Candlestick Park is no good, it's right in the Omnibus dustbin.
I'm aware of the stakes, Okay. I've been practicing in front of a mirror. I've drawn a little eyes on my hand, and I was doing one of those things, pretending to be you. I'm ready.
Senor Wenceslas? Hello.
Yes, I'm ready. I'm practiced. Let's go.
Okay, and you've got a baseball hat on, which is good. It's casual. A sweatshirt of a sports team that looks like the banana slugs.
It couldn't be further from the Bros. It's the National Women's Soccer League team in the Bay Area. It's Bay FC. So this
the
is
Bay FC.
Yes, my two daughters play soccer. We're a big soccer family, so we love the Dern Bay FC.
Now, when you say Bay FC, is that echoing Bayern, the Bavarian soccer team?
I think it's just Bay, in San Francisco, sure. Bay, and then FC because sure. They like to be cutesy in college, you know.
Football club.
Yes, the football club.
Well, congratulations. How old are your daughters?
I have a 17-year-old and I have a 12-year-old.
Wow. Okay. Well, I have a 14 and a half year old, so right in between.
So you know, yeah. It's rewarding. First comes to mind. Rewarding.
Yeah, it's rewarding until they get to 14 and a half and they tell you you're dumb every minute of the day and roll their eyes at you. Like, if she could kill me by rolling her eyes, I would be long in the grave.
The first one is so good at it that her little sister picked it up early, like a language. Like, those neurons got together quickly, and she's like, this guy is a moron, and I'm going to let him know. So I've been hearing it since she was, 7 years old. It's great.
Yeah, good. So you're reporting to us from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm a little bit familiar with your area. Where exactly are you in San Francisco? So, if without doxing yourself.
This is the East Bay. So I am about 5 miles south of the Oakland Coliseum. I'm in a town called Castro Valley, which is just on the other end of the San Mateo Hayward Bridge. So it's real close to where I grew up, but I had no idea that it existed when I grew up. So like coming here was like, wow, what a neat little place. So
Candlestick Park is gone. Am I right? I don't want to like jump ahead.
No. Candlestick Park, it is demolished, and they're really, it's a slow build. It's not like it was terraformed into mixed-use housing or anything like that. It's still very much a little apartment building coming up here, a little bit of this going that place, but definitely just a big, vast nothingness.
So the sea lions are perched on top of the last little bit of a giant stadium. And they're peeing on it and making it smell terrible like Fisherman's Wharf.
Yeah, well, could be making it. I mean, we'll get to, now we're really jumping in because they could have been making it smell better. I mean, Candlestick Point, it's seal urine is a high bar for Candlestick Point to cross, but yeah.
So you grew up in the East Bay, and you've seen the East Bay transform a lot in the course of your life.
I actually grew up in Burlingame, which is just south of the San Francisco airport, and I've definitely seen that change over my lifetime.
God, that's changed completely and utterly.
Yes. It was, my father bought the house, I like to say. It's establishing my bona fides that he was working in a grocery store, you know, and he paid too much for a house and he was nervous about it. Now you can't get on that block unless you are, you know, Tim Cook or something. It's pretty wild.
USA America, that's our story. The grocer who made good and now Mark Zuckerberg bought his whole block in order to start a preschool or whatever it is that's happening down there.
Yes, sir. It's called progress, John. It's called progress.
So you are naturally a pedant, is that right? Like, how did you come by this interest in esoteric knowledge?
It is. So I grew up a Giants fan. My mother was a big Giants fan. My father was a big Giants fan. We would go. They had a Sunday ticket package, and they it's a single income family. So this was their big splurge. And every Sunday we would go, and they had box seats back when that was actually like you had a little box. You know what I mean? And they said they had memories of me in the back playing with Hot Wheels and things like that. So it was in my blood early, but high school, I got more into theater and I decided, you know, sports, not my thing. I fell out of it. That was in the 90s. But then I went to college in Oregon, Southern Oregon, Ashland. When I got to college, I realized I was lonely, homesick. I wanted something that reminded me of home, and that was baseball. That was the Giants. And I really just dove into it. That's the beginning of the internet, too, so I could find people in Oregon to dive down this rabbit hole with me and just go and use it, right, and talk about the Giants in every single move. And from there, I was trying to be like a novelist or a screenwriter. I was trying to be something fancy, but every time I tried to write that stuff, I would fail or I just wouldn't do it. Every time I wanted to write rants about baseball, I just, boom, 2,000 words would fly out of my fingers. So I kept doing it as a way to practice my writing. And eventually that turned into a blog. The blog was acquired by another company, a startup company. That led to one thing. And now I'm working for The Athletic and The New York Times, which is really, really cool. It's a really interesting path.
As a sports writer,
yeah, I cover the Giants for the Athletic. it worked for me. I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
You followed your bliss.
I often say to myself, if I'm this miserable in my dream job, boy, imagine if I didn't like it. You know,
right.
I say that to my family, and they kind of shudder. I guess it was supposed to be a joke, but they don't find it very funny. But yes, no, it's my dream job.
So let me ask you this. Now, I know about baseball. It's very regional. The fandom is very regional. And the West Coast, particularly the Northwest, has a real drought of teams. And it means that the Seattle Mariners are the baseball team for a lot of the Northwest. You'll find Mariners fans in Alaska, in Oregon, in Montana, and Idaho. But the Hawaiians seem to root for the Giants. And I'm wondering where that line in Oregon is. Is Ashland a Giants-based sports economy, or are they rooting for the Mariners?
Boy, that is a loaded question. It's a lot of Bay Area expats up there, much to the consternation of the locals. They don't like the Californians buying up their land, and I don't blame them necessarily. So there is a Giants presence. When I was going to school there, the A's weren't a joke yet. And they had a minor league team in Medford. So the radio broadcast would carry the A's games, and which made me livid. But it was about a 50-50 split. Well, let me say, oh, boy, the calls I made. But the 50-50 split of A's Giants fans, and then I'm doing it wrong. But then there's like a plurality of Mariners fans, I think, is more Mariners fans than A's Giants by a little bit.
And, yeah, when we were kids – the Oakland A's were one of the great sports franchises and legendary both for, you know, their ups and downs. Everybody really seemed to have a very strong opinion about the A's. What happened to the A's? I watched the Brad Pitt sports movie and really liked it. It's a great movie. But can you briefly tell me a little bit about the A's Giants?
Yeah, you know, because it fits into this story in a way, because when we would get A's tickets and go over to an A's game, it was mind-blowing insofar as it was, can you believe how good they have it? Can you believe that Bart goes right to the stadium? Can you believe they have the outfield is open, it's open air? Can you believe the weather's a little bit better? Oakland can get cold at night, but it's not Candlestick. It's not San Francisco cold. So the weather was a perk. Everything was better. And you just envied the A's throughout the 80s. After that, ownership wanted a new stadium. They wanted to not pay for it. It was the wrong city to do that in because the city was bamboozled by the Oakland Raiders, who moved to Los Angeles, came back, extracted all these concessions and monetary gifts and things of that nature, soured the whole area on sports teams demanding those sort of concessions. So the A's were never going to get it. And then at some point, the ownership just said, you know what? We're going to let the fans eat cake. We're not going to pay attention to the team. They're dead to us. We're going to drive down attention. Now we're getting into sort of my fan theory, but this is where the A's said, we want to move. We want to move to Las Vegas. And that's how you get neglect in a team that deserved a little bit better going to Las Vegas.
We had that here in Seattle. All three of our sports teams, the baseball, the basketball, and the football, all argued that their stadium was outdated and they couldn't sell those crucial corporate boxes to subsidize their billion-dollar media empires. And we did it all the way to losing the Seattle Supersonics, which now has absolutely, like, traumatized the entire region. There are people limping in the streets even now with their, you know, their Sonics baseball hats drenched in tears. And it was all this, all these stadium shenanigans and the owners kind of trying to extort public funds to build luxury boxes for corporate swells. And this populist narrative that you're describing, where it's like regular Joes who love sports, always seem to get the shaft, which is a popular American narrative about regular Joes.
It is, but in San Francisco and the Bay Area, they took it a step further where it was a point of civic pride that they were telling the rich people to go shove it. Where there was an era where every Major League Baseball team was getting a new ballpark. This was the 1990s, the 2000s. But in San Francisco, it was famous. Just proposition after proposition just failed, no matter what it was. And then it finally took owners who had bought the team in 1992, I believe, 1993, they came in and they said, we're going to build the ballpark with our money. And we are, you know, we're going to need a little bit from the city when it comes to the infrastructure. Obviously, that turned out to be wildly understated. Sure. Whatever, it was still a privately financed ballpark. And it made people around baseball really mad. But it was the only way it was going to happen because the Bay Area was so sour on public money for private ballparks.
And it made the other owners super mad because it undercut their position that this kind of public extortion was necessary.
Of course.
And it made them all look bad. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like, you can't just pay for a ballpark with your own money. Who does that? You gotta suckle the city's teeth a little bit. You gotta work on this.
So nowadays we think of, and kind of, there's a whole, it's not just the flyover states that have this opinion of San Francisco that it's full of clueless tech bros and billionaires that are just like morally bankrupt. But, and we actually think that up here in Seattle, you probably think that over in Oakland. But still, the vast majority of people living in the Bay Area are working class Joes or regular folks. How does that actually play out in the culture of your region? I mean, I know that you guys hate the people at who have taken over the Mission and turned it into, roller skating lofts or whatever, whoever those people are. But give us just a sense of, like, not just sports fans, but including sports fans, what the middle class is like in the Bay Area.
It's struggling. And when you're talking the middle class, you really have to wonder what you're describing, because you can make an argument that someone making six figures is easily middle class when it comes to housing and stuff like that. So I am able to, in my little bubble, I don't see the California that other people describe in the national media. I'm not constantly surrounded by tech bros who are teaching me the new way to breathe or something like that. Like, it's all puffed up, at least from my experience. Maybe if I were actually in San Francisco proper, in Silicon Valley proper, I would feel like that. Mostly just feels like the houses cost too much. That's just, I know Seattle's the same way, but that, my big takeaway from what the national perception of San Francisco might be is, you're right. Everything costs too much.
Yeah. Driving around Seattle, you're like, who are all these millionaires? Like, how can you even have this many millionaires for every house to be over $1 million? How is that even, where are these people working?
See, that's the difference between you and me, is I drive around and I say, who are all these millionaires? See, it's a throwback.
Well, yeah, that's nice. Well, there used to be a millionaire sitting right there in that chair. And he millionaired himself into a friendship with Matt Damon. So he doesn't have to worry about
I don't even really know this show. I just answered a classified ad. It said, looking for a little funny guy with trivia. And so, hey, that's me. So,
That statement is going to really infuriate the 200 people that have submitted show proposals to this show, who are like, you what?
I'm teasing. I've listened to all. I'm a big project.
You do have to remember that a certain percentage of futurelings are extremely literal.
Of course, as are, there is some overlap in that Venn diagram with people who consume baseball writing. So I am aware, and I am a what you might call a goofy writer. I put in a lot of knock-knock jokes and what have you, so I get it a lot.
And do you ever do radio? I know sports radio is a big universe, and you seem, you've got a face for radio.
Thank you. I've said that myself. I do a podcast. I do a sports baseball podcast called The Roundtable for The Athletic, New York Times. It's me and two buddies making fun of each other, basically. So,
yeah.
Good times.
Good. That's what podcasts are.
Yes.
So my familiarity with Candlestick Park is almost entirely from a rock and roll standpoint.
Yeah.
Some very famous concerts happened there, and it was kind of one of the legendary venues that went away at some point, like all of the legendary venues. Not all of them. There are still some legendary venues. But in the course of growing up in as box holders, did you also attend concerts there?
If we did, it was after the game. It would be some sort of tie-in. So I actually have a poster in my garage of an after-game concert for the Beach Boys. It was the Mike Love Beach Boys. It was, you know, post-Brian Wilson. But I did, as a kid, stay and see the Beach Boys at the end of a concert. But I never got to see a concert there.
Was Rob Lowe the drummer of the Beach Boys for a while? No, it was some other.
John Stamos.
John Stamos.
Yes.
You had that right there, file card.
Yeah, no, you had Beach Boys lore and Beach Boys history. He was, and early, too. I mean, we're not talking John Stamos as a superstar after Full House. He was kind of with them earlier than that. Still a minor celebrity, but fascinating stuff.
Yeah, well, that seems like a future entry in the omnibus, the unlikely career of John Stamos and all of his many permutations. Well, how would you like to get us into to your entry in the omnibus?
No, so you actually teed me up pretty well when you start talking about the culture of San Francisco and the culture of Seattle in a way. I'm trying to find a phrase. I'm trying to use the right adjectives, but I'm failing. It feels like there should be a Latin term for this. It feels like there should be a word in our lexicon. But fart sniffing. It is. San Francisco is one of the great fart sniffing cities in the world. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
I beg your pardon? No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
See, okay. So that
my daughter would accuse me of being a practitioner.
So how would I, thinks it's haughty. It's arrogant. There's an arrogance. You think you are saying to yourself, the city's weird, but the city's special. The city's different. Get a load of us. And in a way, you're kind of drawn to it. I think Paris is a great fart-sniffing city. Mm-hmm. I think San Francisco. And I was curious to know if you have, a better term for it, because clearly that one didn't land.
So what you mean is we would always say they act like their farts don't stink.
Yes. But, right. You know, when you're one of these member cities, you don't care. You're actually into the whole vibe of everything that you're about. And I think San Francisco is one of those great cities. I think from down here, it feels like Seattle kind of thinks of itself as a certain cosmopolitan that's on a different maybe level. Am I overreading into that?
No, you're absolutely right. I've gone on record a lot comparing Seattle, Portland, and Vancouver, because Seattle always wanted to be the city of the future and made and continues to make policy decisions, cultural choices where it's really too big for its britches, considering that for most of its history, it was a resource extraction city based entirely on what we could just pull out of the ground or rob from the seas. And, but you know, we were always like Opera House and this old, beautiful half a block sized Carnegie Library is too musty. We're going to build a modernist. We're going to tear it down and build a modernist library that will reflect, you know, a modernist library that within 6 years, the toilets don't flush. That will reflect our, you know, like space age presence on the Pacific Rim, whereas Portland was just a shitty little place that stayed shitty. They didn't have a dollar, you know, they did not have a dollar to do any of that. And now they look like geniuses because their town is like fairly well preserved, and Vancouver was just like woohoo, with very little like. Everybody's welcome. Like, you know, build it up. So, Seattle has been hoisted by its own petard a lot because it just, it feels like it's something that really its actual performance does not reflect its self-image.
So this is where the Giants are in the middle of the 50s. This is where San Francisco is in the middle of the 50s. This is, it's Baghdad by the Bay. This is San Francisco, and they're better than you, and they don't care if you are upset that they're telling you. There's a lot of civic pride. Everyone is just gurgling with this San Francisco pride, but they don't have a baseball team. They can't fit in with the East Coast. They've got this little brother complex, both with the East Coast writ large and also Los Angeles. of course. So they're a little insecure about their place in the world. They want Manifest Destiny to finally reach them and get a baseball team. So they pass a bond, a $5 million bond, a lot of clams back then, and it was to lure a team to come to San Francisco. Well, then it gets to the Dodgers are planning to move to Los Angeles. The Giants aren't very happy in New York. They go to the owner. They meet with the owner, the representatives from San Francisco. They meet with Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants. They say, you're going to love this.
Horace Stoneham.
Horace Stoneham. Oh, he was a gem. And they go to him and they say, hey, you're going to love this. San Francisco, we've approved $5 million with an M dollars. Mm-hmm. And he laughed them out of the room. He said, you can't do that. I'm not moving for a $5 million team. It has to be $10 million, at least $15
million. And, New York dollars.
Yeah, he didn't take kindly to that.
Yeah. And so there's always been, and you're a sports writer, so explain this to those of us who don't quite understand this. There's a limited number of baseball teams, and you can't just say, we're starting a baseball team. You have to get a baseball team from a limited pool. Now, why is that, and when do they add new baseball teams? Because it seems like there's not just 15 baseball teams. Like, what is that process?
Well, there's something called the antitrust exemption. So baseball is effectively allowed to operate as a monopoly in a lot of ways. It doesn't have to follow a lot of the same rules that others might because it's seen as something for the public benefit in a way. So now because right now the league is at 30 teams, which is not ideal for scheduling. To have two additional teams, 32, would make so much sense. It would even out divisions. The scheduling would be easier. But they're waiting for the right moment when all the ballparks that they've been trying to extract are in place. Like they finally got Las Vegas done. They're trying to, I'm sure Portland is on their list. Nashville, they're trying to figure out, how much they can get out of them and if any teams might want to move still. I think we're about at the end of teams they can move. So the next step is to say, yes, we are going to accept bids for expansion franchises and then teams will submit bids. There's going to be a fee, probably $1 billion to join the club. And then there's going to be the sale price of the franchise and all that stuff. And it's going to be popular. It's going to be a lot of baseball teams don't lose money. They always make money. They always sell at a profit. So there's going to be quite the elbowing to try and get an expansion team.
But does this have everything to do with television? Like, why aren't there 50 baseball teams? There certainly are 50 American cities that would want one.
Well, they're actually cutting minor league cities. They really just, the number of cities with professional baseball now drastically reduced since the pandemic. They want, more teams means more thumbs in the pie, and you want to control that to some point, but you also don't want to dilute the competition. I mean, if I'm a big, I don't think that expansion is a bad idea. I'm happy to have 32 teams, but if you start getting to 50, well, you start to really thin out the talent pool, something like that. So every league's going to try and cap the league at about 30, 32.
Is thumbs in the pie a saying in baseball writing? I don't remember hearing thumbs in the pie. Although, is that like a Jack Spratt puts his thumb in a pie?
It's entirely possible I invented it. I'm thumbs very good pie. At that. But yeah,
no, I like it.
Well, you can picture a bunch of CEOs and you can picture a bunch of people who might have thumbs in a pie that they want, and they're all just sitting there with a thumb in a pie. It's very evocative.
It stems from a nursery rhyme. Little Jack Horner put a thumb in his Christmas pie to pull out a plum, and he said, "What a good boy am I." So, thumbs in a pie. When hair starts to thin, confidence can too. That's why Hims makes it simple to feel like yourself again, with access to simple, personalized care that fits your life and your hair goals. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays. These are doctor-trusted ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil, and they can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months.
You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. There are no hidden fees, no surprise costs, just real personalized care on your schedule. Think of Hims as your digital front door that gets you back to your old self with simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for real health concerns all in one place. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, erectile dysfunction, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's Hims, H-I-M-S, .com/omnibus for your free online visit. hims.com/omnibus. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride.
So we have a limited number of baseball teams. San Francisco thinks very highly of itself.
Yes.
And this is before San Francisco was full of millionaires. It thinks highly of itself because it's the city by the bay. It's the city that rocks. It's the city that never stops.
Yes, yes. And so now you have the city has approved a bond. They think they're easily going to lure the New York Giants. The New York Giants sniff. So what the city does is they create a dummy corporation. They create a dummy corporation called Stadium Incorporated, and what it is it's just an arm of the city. It is just a dummy corporation where you can issue bonds at a higher rate than the city would get, but you would issue bonds without any sort of oversight, without any sort of vote, without any sort of public meetings.
Without any vote?
Yeah. So this is the city just creating out of thin air an arm to give the New York Giants what they want, to fill their coffers and bring them on over, and they'll provide a new stadium for them.
Now, you're probably in a good position to answer this question. City, as you said in the monopoly, part of the justification of the monopoly is that baseball is a public good. It's a civic institution, and cities and baseball teams often make the case that public money going into baseball is going to be profitable for the municipality, for the local government. It's going to increase services. The tax base is going to raise, and we're going to have better buses and so forth. And all of this is going to improve our lives above and beyond just the fact that we have a place to drink beer in the afternoon. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes and no, because, and more explicitly, no, because it never pencils out. You can get economists to say, oh, yes, here's how it works, and they're typically hired by the teams. They're typically said, hey, pencil this out, and they'll pencil it out. What they find, though, when they do the serious studies is that the income that's spent in that area a lot of times is coming from another area of the region. It's not new money that's coming in. It's just a redistribution of the economy from a different place. So that's kind of the reality of the situation. But they're doing all this stuff with the Giants in the 1950s as well. And they're saying, this is going to pay for itself. And no, it didn't. It didn't come close. The Giants ended up losing money year after year after year on this deal. But at the same time, can you say at some point the Giants became a net benefit to the area? And I don't know. Probably. I mean, it seems like it. It would be weird to imagine the city without this sporting institution. So at some point, the numbers flip and it becomes, a cost benefit. But I don't know. That's above my pay grade.
Yeah. Yeah. So were they able then to meet the $10 million demands of the Giants?
They were. And this is where we get the contractor into the story. His name is Charles L. Harney, and he is going to be the protagonist for the most part. He is a man of presidential timber, but not back then. I'm talking right now.
Oh, so I see what you mean.
So he is he's the contractor, and as he gets the bid, or okay, let's back up. He's the contractor, but now San Francisco is roughly the size of Wilmington, North Carolina, geographically speaking. It's a small city, so you don't necessarily have places to put a stadium. Well, this gentleman who happens to be a contractor, Charles Harney, he happened to have 77 acres of salt marsh that he bought from the city 2 years before, 3 years before. He paid $2,100 an acre for this, and he was happy to sell it back to them for $65,000 an acre. Mm-hmm. And the city, well, I don't know if the city said yes, but he was cozy with the mayor, and the mayor said yes. The mayor said, this is our guy. This is our guy, because what San Francisco wanted, they didn't just want a baseball team. They wanted an architectural marvel. You know, you're talking about the Opera House in Seattle. They want something that, you know, any old city can have a ballpark. But San Francisco, we've got the blank. And so they want the blank. And so they're telling everyone that this guy's going to give them the blank. He's the right guy for the job. And he's spinning these tales, too. He is saying, you know, there's going to be a fountain out front. The chief architect is
fountain.
Well, it's a fountain. It's not just a fountain. It's going to be a fountain that will really be something. And when someone tells you there's going to be a fountain that will, quote, really be something, what are you picturing in your head?
Ooh, I'm thinking, well, and this era, I'm thinking like a real space age fountain. You know, we've got a few of those around here, space age fountains.
Yes.
A lot of them, they stopped putting water in during some of the environmental crises. But what am I thinking? I'm thinking it's white. It kind of looks like a robot spider. Yeah. Am I close?
Well, it never was put in, but yeah, I'm with you. But no, it was, this is the Jetsons. This is space age stuff. You want a fountain that will blow your socks off.
That'll really be something.
Yeah. But, never came in. It said it would have drive-in ticket windows. That didn't come. It said it was going to have a year round exclusive clubhouse for 700 people. It was going to be a gaily colored park. It was going to be just a bit, you know, and it ended up gray, which is one of the gayer colors, I think, out there. It's a lovely, gaily colored park, if, you know, gaily colored is gray. So this is what the idea, they're trying to just make this their Sydney Opera House, right? They're trying to do this a magical thing, and they give it to this guy. Well, first off, Stadium Incorporated, this is the dummy corporation, it needs a board. And so on the board, the president of the board is Charles Harney, who's also the contractor. Right next
that
to him
checks out.
Is his brother-in-law. And then on the board as well is the executive vice president of the Charles Harney Construction Company. So these are the people who are in charge of the one arm of the money. And what it leads to is a lot of the newspaper coverage at the time will describe it as a partnership between Charles Harney, the stadium's contractor, and the city. And it gets put in that he's losing money. You know, he's by grading out the land, he's losing all this money. Well,
wow.
It's
what
not
a
him.
Martyr.
It's not, it's Stadium Incorporated, which again is the city itself. And it's the grift started early and it started often.
Now, nowadays, I think urbanists, and in particular liberal urbanists, although that's a redundancy, will always kind of set the contractor, in particular the big contractor, as the villain in almost any story about urbanism. Anytime you're talking about insufficient housing, anytime you're talking about the grift of public money, there's always a contractor somewhere who's profiting off of what I guess should be the public good.
Yes.
But I don't get the feeling that was true in the late 50s.
Yes, it was. There was a little bit of muckraking, but it wasn't very effective. It wasn't very loud. It didn't come in the Chronicle. What you would get in the Chronicle is there was eventually a grand jury that was called. And the grand jury found that there was nothing that they could find that was definitively shady. They just said San Francisco got a really bad deal. That was their finding, is that they got a really bad deal. But there was some muckraking. There was a prominent Republican businessman in San Francisco who, a very well-respected fella, who essentially ground his reputation into the mud by trying to figure out the handshake deals that went on for all of this. And it was a pretty sad story. Eventually they ground him down. He gave up, died from a heart attack a couple years later.
Wow. So it was a Republican congressman that was the ombudsman here.
Or a Republican businessman.
Businessman.
Man about society.
Back when we could trust the Republican Party to be full of people of integrity.
This is very clearly, you can see the parallels with, I don't know, who are the Mitt Romneys of the world, the ones that tried to make the stand, and boy, it didn't work out for them. So.
Yeah, when frugality was a conservative, like a, you know, conservative virtue.
Those were those were the heady days.
So now, thinking about the salt marsh for futurelings who are living in a Oceania, or just for people that live in Australia and don't know about the geography of San Francisco, there's an enormous bay, and the bay kind of trends into marshy muck on most of its southern. Everything's south of Oakland, really. It's just mucky, marshy muck. And over the course of the history of the Bay Area, a lot of that's been filled in. A lot of it's dumped horse carcasses and old cans and wagons, and created somewhat solid ground, which is true here in Seattle. A lot of solid ground that you really hope the big earthquake doesn't come, because it's all going to liquefy and go right back into the ocean. But how much of this salt marsh, he bought the salt marsh completely speculatively, thinking that he was going to what with it? And then how, I mean, this seems like a real fortuitous kind of like basically flipping this mucky marsh.
Yes, it does seem a little convenient that the person who had all the ballpark land was also a contractor who was also very chummy with the mayor, who could also get a no-bid contract from that mayor, because it would be, if you're using Stadium Incorporated, you don't have to have a bid. It's a totally separate arm, even though it's the city itself. So, yeah, how does that guy end up with all of this land? I mean, yeah, I never found research that said it was always in the works, but that would be the logical conclusion to reach, is that at some point they said, you know, if they bring a team here to the West Coast, where are they going to build a stadium? There's only one real solution. Yeah.
Hey there.
And so he said, well, by Jove, I'm going to be the one that gets that thumb in the pie.
And these marshes these days wouldn't be buildable. It would be considered an environmental catastrophe because the ducks would have nowhere to land, right? I mean, how much of those marshes are now being repaired in the Bay Area? Because there's, when you fly over it, right, it's just like salt farms and crazy. It doesn't seem like it's being maintained.
No, because it's terrible, terrible land. It is useless. It is so. A lot of the land that he sold back to the city was to fill in what needed the land that needed to be the site for the ballpark. So that was where a lot of the land ended up going. They had to fill all that in. But the part about Candlestick Point, so it's a marsh. It is, I mean, it really is, you know, the scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where he's talking about the castle, and you know, the first one falls down, the second one falls down, catches on fire, then falls in the swamp. It's like that. You know, you can't build anything on that. And so you have this land, and it is awful land, but it's also freezing. Freezing in a way that even in San Francisco, it's a different kind of freezing, right?
Is this because the air kind of comes over the coastal range in a certain way? Is this like a atmospheric river of a kind?
Yes, it is. It is exactly that. You have the winds coming in from the west. These are cold Pacific winds, and they're just shooting right over Brisbane. They're going right through into this valley and just making a left turn and then a right and just going boom right into where the ballpark was eventually built. It really, you will meet people who will talk about this like it's an Arctic expedition. It really was. It really was like that to watch some games at Candlestick sometimes.
10 degrees colder than you would find just 5 miles north.
Yes, and somehow the wind, you know, the wind chill is amplified somehow. You don't know what the physics are behind it. It's just worse. It's just the coldest you've ever been, no matter what.
The coldest winter coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco, as my dad said every chance he got.
Yes, it's true. And there was an apocryphal story a long time later that they took members of the Board of Supervisors out to this part of the city, and they made sure to do it in October. September and October is kind of like San Francisco summer, and you could really get some nice weather at Candlestick Point in September and October. And the urban legend was that they took them there, and they said, here's where it's going to be. And they all, you know, doffed their caps and said, by Joel, this is perfect. It wasn't true, unfortunately. It was this land that was owned. But there was a real story where they brought the National League president at the time. His name was Chubb Feeney. And sure, I'll just pause here because I believe firmly that we need more Chubbs in modern discourse.
Yeah, well, I mean, where Chubb Feeney... What his parents were thinking, I mean, I know what his parents were thinking when he was born. He was a little chubbins. But to think like this is going to be a name that's going to carry this guy through the rest of his life. And what is Chubb is probably short for chubbins.
Chubbington.
Chubbington. Yeah.
Chubbington. Right. So you get Chubb Feeney, and he's taking a tour of the site, and he says, to a worker there, he says, gosh, it's awfully windy. It's awfully windy here. Really, really windy. He said, always this windy. And the worker said, well, not really, but it picks up from about 1 to 4 and from about 7 in the evening till about 11 o'clock.
So just when baseball games are scheduled.
Exactly. When baseball games are scheduled, that is when the winds would howl the most. So it's cold. It's a marsh. It is not really accessible. You know, this is still the era where people would get on a bus on purpose to go to an event. There was that, but it was not close to anything. In the middle of the planning, there was a supervisor who freaked out and said, actually, no, we have to get this downtown. He had a vision and this is where it has to be. But back then it was still, you know, downtown wasn't the magic that it might have today. You know, you want to be in the suburbs. You want to kind of be on the edge of the city. But it wasn't very accessible. Another thing, though, is that it stinks because you have across the freeway the garbage dump for the city and county of San Francisco. And it's been there since 1900. And it was a foul place. And especially after a Saturday game, you'd sit in traffic. And if you had to go south, you would just be in bumper to bumper traffic, trying to get on the on-ramp and just marinating in some good old landfill. Some of my formative memories, I should say.
Right. The landfill would be upwind of the stadium too. It's the wind has to go over the landfill in order to get
I believe so. So occasionally it would stink when you parked in the parking lot, which was typically underwater. You would park there, squish your way into the ballpark. It would stink a lot of the way there.
And this is, so we're still talking about the late 1950s, right? Mid to late 1950s?
Yeah, it opens opening day 1960, but the construction is going on starting in 57, I believe.
Skyway to the Bay Bridge opened in 1955. And the freeway within San Francisco was completed in 1958. So this is all happening at once. San Francisco's joining the jet age.
Yes, yes. And you've been clever enough to take that highway and put the garbage dump on one side, which is great, you know, for separating it from homes and what have you. But the smell, you can't eat. A freeway is not going to take care of the smell. So That's where Candlestick Park is being built. It is on marsh in a freezing, freezing, freezing cold area, and it kind of stinks. But this was the space age, so the cold wasn't a problem. Okay, the cold they had solved. The cold was, first off, they were going to orient the ballpark so that it would not, the wind wasn't going to be a factor. They were going to, I mean, they didn't have computers, so I'm assuming they're using abacuses and, you know, figuring out how the wind works, and that's not going to be a problem. But more importantly, they have Popular Mechanics was very happy to write about this. They had radiant heating underneath the seats.
No, they didn't.
They were going to have a water boiler that pumped hot boiling water throughout the ballpark, a circulation system, and it was going to heat up the whole ballpark from the concrete out.
And so, was this fusion powered? How did they heat these boilers?
Boy, I don't know how you would power something like that. I mean, it's the 50s. You're probably not throwing orphans into it. You probably, that's you know, the Gilded Age.
If they were if they were smart, they would use the methane from the garbage dump to power the boilers for the radiant heating. But did this system work? Whatever it was they used, it was probably coal, but whatever they used, how did it work?
It did not, because it was encased in concrete. Which it never worked. They turned it on. No one really made the calculations. No one really thought to ask, hey, how much heat is going to be generated? Because I guess this opens up the possibility it could have been the other way, where they flipped the switch and just immolated people, you know, trying to watch a nice, happy baseball game. They just didn't know. And it was one of the more expensive perks, whatever you call it, cherries on top of the sundae, just didn't work from day one.
Wow. Oh, well, you know, what they do now is put windmills all around it and use that wind, that garbage smelling wind, to power the boiler that's not heating the seats.
See, I've always said America's energy crisis, fetid air. Just more fetid air, I think, is what we need.
It's more likely to burn. Fetid air is more likely to burn.
So you have this ballpark that's going up, and you're getting the promises from this contractor, and then he's going back and asking for more money, and he's saying, "Gosh, you know, this is a little bit more than I thought. I'm losing my personal stake." Again, he never had a personal stake in it, but he's getting more and more money. Finally, there's a grand jury. The grand jury says everything's on the up and up, but we're going to replace the people at the top of the board of Stadium Inc., and we're going to really get this done. This is 1959 now, and in 1959 the Giants were surprisingly good. In the meantime, so they're already here. They've moved to San Francisco. I guess that's an important part of the story. But they're here. They're in Seals Stadium, which is a Pacific Coast League ballpark. The San Francisco Seals had a rich tradition with Joe DiMaggio, and they had you know, all the great local players. Tony Lazzari would go up through the San Francisco Seals, and that was their ball team.
Okay, so they're playing in the Seals Stadium. Is that not big enough to accommodate the audience?
Correct. It's about 20 some odd thousand people. You know, if you're in a major league ballpark in the 50s, you're going to want 40,000 at least. So they want to, yes, have a new ballpark. They're playing in Seals Stadium for now. But 1959, the Giants were surprisingly good. And in 1959, if you were good enough to win the league that you're in, straight to the World Series, baby. You are right in. There's no, oh, we have to go through these four rounds. You were win nice. And in. So the whole summer, people are going, you know, it would be cool is if the Giants made the World Series and the new ballpark was open. And so from there, you get a constant stringing along, like, oh, yeah, you know, we can have it ready by Labor Day, and you could have it ready. Nothing ever materialized. The Giants ended up not making the World Series, so it was a moot point. But there was at one point this idea, like, this is going to be open, and the world is going to be at our doorstep, and we're going to get to show this sucker off.
Right. Gosh, that would have been exciting times. Do you know whether Marilyn Monroe ever attended a game?
No. Damn, I wish.
Lenny Bruce? I mean, any of the...
let's see. Well, the Beatles. I mean, of course, the Beatles. That's the concert, the famous last concert. The Rolling Stones played there. Pope John Paul II. He gave a
great show.
A song.
Great show.
He gave a the opener. Anyways, but yeah. So it had a little bit of its place in pop culture, but they couldn't get it ready before that season, or before the World Series, I should say. And in 1960, it finally opens. But before that, you have our hero, protagonist, Charles Harney, leading reporters through Candlestick Park and pointing out all of the flaws that will need to be fixed because the contract, the original contract between the city and Stadium Incorporated, which is also the city, didn't include weatherproofing. And so he needed more millions to, it wasn't that much money. He's needed more millions to actually weatherproof the area. And he's taking reporters around going, yeah, see, that could be fixed. That could be fixed real easy. We just need to do this. And oh yeah, you see that? Those joists are going to leak and all that stuff. The umpire's room, there was a puddle in it when reporters visited. Now you might have a question about this.
Yeah. I mean, this is stuff they teach you in contractor school.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, hey, the big reveal is me complaining about needing more money to finish it. But
it seems like the thing a contractor would have done already. It seems,
oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, weatherproof a thing in the city that rains.
It seems like if you're building a place, making sure it's just not a sieve, making sure that the umpire's room, it seems like all these problems would be something you're responsible for as the person in charge of building it.
In fact, it would be like in the architecture of it. Like it would have been maybe the first thing you thought of.
Yeah. So that's where we're at with this. Is it's a dump. It is in a stinky place. Mm. It is it's just nothing about it is working. It is the infield is of particular interest because he's doing the infield himself, this guy Charles Harney. He is saying, I'll put your infield in. That's what the contract says. But in baseball, the infield's a big deal. It's going to, you know, it's going to reflect how ground balls bounce. It's going to be how the field plays. It's going to be a real big storyline in every game. So you can't just have any old grass. You can't just throw down some sod and say it's here. So the groundskeeper, the head groundskeeper, they're actually trying to get him over from New York. He was going to be the guy who was the head groundskeeper at the Polo Grounds. They're getting over from New York, and he said, please, just go away. Let me take care of the grass. We opening days in a few months. Please, just go away. And eventually they came to an agreement where he was paid to go away because in the contract, that's what his job was. So you're taking his job away from him after the contract signed. You can't do that. Well, okay. So then they got the grass in. Finally, it's 1960 and it's opening day. And I got to tell you, the reviews at first, sparkling. Sparkling. So opening day is you've got Vice President Richard Nixon throwing out the first pitch.
One of the great Californians.
One of the Californians, as I like to refer to him. Ty Cobb is there. You've got a whole host of celebrities. You have baseball royalty. And when Richard Nixon is there, he tells the press, he says, I really do think this is the best ballpark in the country.
And Nixon's a sports fan, too, and a baseball fan.
Because here's the thing. When you're there, you see, and at the time it wasn't closed in, it has beautiful bay views. It had, I should say. You're looking over, you can see the East Bay. You can see the San Francisco Bay. It was a beautiful ballpark in a lot of ways. We'll get to how that changed, but at first, it could make a pretty good impression. And the way I described it was, I was, as a Star Wars nerd, so excited to see The Phantom Menace in the theaters. I had a midnight showing. I had decades of anticipation building up inside of me. I was just, this is all I'd been waiting for. And then I saw it. And I didn't say that movie just absolutely stinks. I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, that movie's pretty cool. That movie's okay. And then you try and process it. And then you see it a second, third time, and it's one of the worst movies you've ever seen.
What about the trade wars? I mean, that's, you know.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it is. And so you're sitting there, you're trying to process this like, heck yeah, trade wars. Let's go. You know, this is exactly how I imagined it, you know, back in, you know, 1989, I was thinking about the trade wars. There's an itch I couldn't scratch. What happened to him? But then eventually you realize it's just a bad movie. And I think there was some of that with Candlestick Park too. It was so hyped. It was so what San Francisco wanted it to be if you looked at it in the right way, but it just ultimately wasn't.
The thing about a baseball season, as you well know, is that it's really a long involved, more than really any other sports kind of experience. you start in what feels like too early in the spring, and then it just goes and goes and goes. And if you're a baseball fan, you go to many, many games, and any one victory or defeat kind of doesn't really matter for months and months. It's like, oh, we lost, whatever. Tomorrow is a new day. And even the best team in baseball loses dozens and dozens of games. And so I would imagine that the opening day, there's a lot of excitement, but really for the people going to baseball games, they're going to get it. They're going to see games on every kind of day. It's never from day to day. And this is true of the weather in San Francisco too. From day to day, from hour to hour, it could be really anything. I mean, more than any other city, I think, in the world, it could be anything. And then an hour later, it could be the opposite.
Yeah. And this is actually kind of where the genesis for the article that I wrote about Candlestick Park, it was during the pandemic, the hard lockdown part of the pandemic, where there are no sports. And so editors were saying, hey, get creative and be good. Make sure people read it. So I wrote this during the pandemic. And my question was, when did everyone realize it was terrible? Because no one sets out to build the world's worst ballpark. No one is saying, I've got a great idea. You know, that marshland that stinks? That's going to be what we need. But at some point, everyone started to notice. And so the weather, obviously, all that was promised about Bayview Hill is going to break the wind and things like this, no, that didn't work. So that was obvious right at the front, as where there's no drive-in ticket windows. There is no gaily colored exterior. There is
no fountain
you can see from space. You know, there's nothing like that. But okay, so you're trying to deal with it, and you're putting a good foot forward, and then the ballpark starts murdering people.
Huh?
Yes, this is, I kept seeing references to Cardiac Hill. And what Cardiac Hill was how you got in the ballpark. You would park, and then you would walk up a hill. But they named it Cardiac Hill after the sixth heart attack, fatal heart attack. There were a lot of heart attacks before that, but this is in the first, I'd say, 2 years of the ballpark. You had a good number of fatal heart attacks. I mean, look, 1960, everyone walking up is smoking two cigarettes and eating a raw piece of steak. But
sure, they had pork chops for breakfast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, it's not the best press that you can get. And Cardiac Hill stuck. And it eventually claimed, I want to say in the dozens, people fatal heart attacks. And when I wrote this story, I had a couple people write in and say, yeah, that's how my grandpa went. Cardiac Hill, you would just walk up and that was it. That's how steep the hill was.
As a middle-aged man, I hate stories like this.
Yes, same.
Because every time I get winded doing anything, I'm like, oh God, is this the big one? Like,
yes. Yes, it is. You know, when I was going to Candlestick, it was an escalator. You would walk up to this plaza area, and this giant escalator would take you up to get into the stadium. And it was, as a kid, it was super cool. It was, you're riding the world's biggest escalator, or at least the biggest one you've ever seen, up to the baseball stadium. And it was cool as heck. But before that, a few people had to die.
So the escalator was kind of a patch, like...
Yes.
I see, an add-on.
This was later. This was, we got to stop killing our customers, which every CEO, every company, they got to face that at some point.
And so dozens die, but presumably that didn't turn the public against Candlestick Park right away either.
No, it was just sort of the malaise that would slowly start to grip the area, because the 70s were a rough time for San Francisco. This is the natural output of a lot of people saying, I'm going to go here, do some drugs, see where it takes me. And then in the years that followed, it didn't necessarily take them anywhere. And so the city was in a real rough spot. Even by 70s blight standards, San Francisco really had it rough in the 70s.
And it can't all be drug-addicted Grateful Dead fans. There had to have also been a decline in manufacturing or some other industrial base. Like, what was San Francisco? It's been 100 years since there was a gold rush.
Right.
What was powering San Francisco that went away?
It was, it was a port, but I can't really answer that question. I do know that when you would drive to Candlestick Park, you would see a big sign on the hillside, like a Hollywood sign that read, South San Francisco, the industrial city. But I couldn't tell you what they industried.
Right. Well, they made Itzits.
Yeah.
We know.
Yes.
That's one thing they make there.
Oh,
Itzits.
I had an Itzits shirt, and it still comes up a lot because my wife stole it from me, and it was one of my favorite shirts. So we take that very seriously here.
Right down the block, there used to be a very expensive grocery store, one of those places that had 400 kinds of olives. Yeah. And that place closed because nobody went there. And it was replaced with a grocery outlet, which people who have grocery outlets, they're affectionately called the gross out. And what they are is they're a grocery store that takes remaindered goods from 1 week to the next. You can't be sure what's going to be there. There'll be a kind of grocery that you get really addicted to. It's much cheaper than you would find elsewhere. And then 2 weeks later, it's gone and you never see it again.
Yep.
But one thing that's always there are these mini Itzits. And for those listening, Itzits are a San Francisco delicacy, which is two very large oatmeal cookies that make a sandwich with vanilla ice cream. And then the whole thing is dipped in chocolate. They're 10,000 calories, and they're the size of the largest cheeseburger you ever saw. They're like an enormous dessert. And these mini Itzits are still a huge dessert, but I love them, and I eat Itzits all the time, which nobody can believe.
Oh, yeah. I would take those Itzit minis and put them in a bowl with some milk in it and just have it like cereal. Itzits are in our blood. That's like when we go to family functions, my mom literally brings out, she goes to the Itzit outlet store in her town and says, here's what I got, pumpkin, green tea. I mean, anything you want, baby.
Oh, wow. The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Yeah.
Okay, so San Francisco is on the decline like everywhere. You know, Seattle at that point had a billboard that said, "Will the last person leaving Seattle please turn out the lights?"
Yes.
And that was famous, like basically our funniest moment
for
a decade.
until the New York Times article with the fake grunge lexicon. That was the next one.
Wax.
But San Francisco in the 70s, obviously it's going downhill, but Candlestick Park and the Giants are a perfect civic metaphor throughout all of this, because the Giants were the team of Willie Mays. That's who's coming west with the Giants is Willie Mays, the greatest superstar of them all. Now he's San Francisco's. Well, in the 70s, he's gone. He's aged. He was traded to the Mets. He's no longer in baseball. Willie McCovey, he's gone now. You start to see the decline. All the superstars are gone. In the stadium, they put in AstroTurf. And so AstroTurf in the 70s. Now it's different. When you say they've got artificial surfaces now, totally different. It is easy on your body, easy to drain, a lot of times preferable. Back then, it was terrible. It was terrible.
Isn't AstroTurf, if you had a baseball, like a line drive on AstroTurf, doesn't it like skip like a rock on a yes. pond, or it like actually accelerates when it hits the ground?
Yes, it does weird things, and it's terrible on players' knees. The Montreal Expos had a player, Andre Dawson, who would make the Hall of Fame, but the turf in Montreal wrecked his knees, and so he wasn't able to be the same kind of outfielder when he went to the Cubs that he was. And this was very, not acceptable, but it was commonplace. And it could also grab someone if you're trying to pivot. It loved to grab cleats and say, cleat, you stay here, while the rest of the athlete's body goes in a different direction. So turf was just awful from the get-go. It was something that was a blight on basically every sport that it touched. And now it was in Candlestick Park.
Who were the baseball stars of 70s Giants?
Well, see, okay, so Bobby Bonds, the father of Barry Bonds, he stuck around for a little bit in the 70s, but for the most part, the answer is 404, not found. I mean, there just weren't a lot of superstars. And throughout all of this, the Dodgers aren't just winning World Series. The Dodgers aren't just being the successful franchise in the city that is still 100 times more glamorous than San Francisco. The Dodgers are doing all of this in a perfect ballpark, just this ballpark that they built with some private money, and it is just exquisite. Everyone loves Dodger Stadium. It ranks high in the rankings of best ballparks with the Giants dead last. So now you've got just all these feelings gurgling under the surface when it comes to the Giants and how much they've muffed this Candlestick Park thing.
And so you implied that there were additions made to Candlestick Park, not just an escalator, but there were other improvements?
Yeah. So when the 49ers decided to move into Candlestick Park, they enclosed it. And so this is taking away the bay views, but at the same time, a lot of people were going, it's about time, because that is going to take care of the wind. So, you know, the region was generally okay with, okay, close that sucker up, get the Niners in there, we'll share it. It's going to take a little bit of the character away, but boy, we need it, because it's going to stop the wind, which, of course, it did not.
How do you build a huge roof on top of a building that was not designed to have a roof?
Well, it's not a roof. So it is, when I say they enclosed it, it's around the perimeter. So it is. So you have an open air. You're talking, if you're looking out to center field, you're seeing the Oakland Hills. Now you're seeing seats, an upper deck. You know, that's where I sat for the 1984 All-Star game, was way out there.
I see. So they also, in closing it, they also added more.
Tons more seats. And so they did this. It's all enclosed and it's just as cold as ever. And so now they're thinking, well, okay, we have this idea. They're always trying these ideas. And this one is going to be, there's going to be a lip that kind of comes. It's going to be not a hat, but it's going to, you have where the ballpark ends, and then you're going to have a little bit of a something going out towards the field. A little, I don't even know what you call it. Not a roof.
Awning.
A little awning, right? And it was controversial because no one knew if it would make things better. But everyone, it was like people would write opposing letters to the editor in the San Francisco Chronicle as a civic debate. It was, yes, we need the lip. We need the lip because it's going to do this. And I know it made it worse. They built it, made it worse.
Well, wait, aren't there scientists? I mean, this seems like a thing that scientists would be able to tell us about fluid dynamics or air dynamics.
I think, yeah, because right now, even with supercomputers, it's hard to model. I know that hydrodynamics is really, really, really tricky to predict, and you're baking in a lot of assumptions, and weather, of course, is a similar thing. So before computers, I would think it's really just in a different state, this sort of, because you remember growing up with, the weatherman sure was wrong today, you know, because that's, they were just kind of throwing things, and they didn't have a computer.
Sure, they were standing on top of a hill and looking out and going like, looks cloudy.
Yeah. And so I think it was some of that.
Wow. So it's just Hail Mary after Hail Mary.
Yeah. And they're trying to figure all this stuff out. Nothing works. In the 80s, the Giants try to start leaning into it, and they start –
What, this is our vibe? They're putting it on t-shirts?
Yes. So this is, they are running ads that are people coming in with Arctic gear and just shivering, and they're Giants fans, and that's the premise of the ad campaign, is this place is freezing, but it's our freezing. This is, you know, this is going to build character sort of thing.
Right. And this is the park you grew up in.
This is the park I grew up in. And
so you were born what year?
1977.
77. So you are Generation X, although those of us born a decade before would consider you some kind of children.
Yes.
But still, you get to claim Generation X. But that means you were prime baseball age right during the 1980s.
Yes.
Where kind of what people forget is during the 1980s, everything had gone to shit. It wasn't just like the way things went shit in the 60s and 70s. By the 80s, it was firmly shit.
Yes.
Nothing had been improved or even painted in decades.
Yes.
And that was true of your ballpark. Was it also crumbling? Was the concrete also like cracking?
I don't remember physical, structural, not when I was really going there every day. So I think it was, strong like bull, but at the same time, it built character. And so when I say that they're leaning into it, there was a prize that if you stayed through the entire game of an extra innings game at night, you got a little pin. And the little pin, it was a silver pin. It's called the Quad Candlestick. And it is a silver pin, and you only got it if you stayed. You couldn't buy them. You couldn't get them anywhere else. You had to stay for an extra innings game. And it had a picture of this Giants pitcher from 1962 where there was a sudden gust of wind during the All-Star game, and he's about to pitch. The wind, apocryphally perhaps, blew him off. And he was called for a balk. And so that was a very famous moment where the wind caused something. And that was really nationally when Candlestick got that reputation, because everyone's watching the All-Star game back in the 60s. You had three channels and, you know, two of them were the All-Star game. And so it was a big deal. And that's where Candlestick kind of got its reputation back then.
The burst of wind actually blew him off the mound?
It distracted him enough to where he tried to pause, perhaps. But in the popular telling, yeah, it picked him up and, you know, spun him around like a plastic bag.
So another thing that's true of baseball is that there's all this. It's a statistics-driven fan base. Everybody's, like, counting every little tiny variation. And ballparks have reputations being easy to hit home runs, hard to hit home runs. And a lot of that is like, what's the dew point in the city? How, you know, how well do balls fly through the air based on factors that seem to be like, are they joyful? I mean, there's just, it's an insane amount of micro analysis. Did the wind ever take a ball and make it do like a home run ball and make it do funny things in the air?
All the time. And so this is in the retelling of the history, you will get people who will say, well, Willie Mays hit 660 home runs, but if he didn't play at Candlestick, because you could absolutely crush a ball as hard as you could hit it. And it could be in any other ballpark, 50 rows deep, but in Candlestick, it would blow back. There were absolutely those kinds of balls, but then there would be, you know, I'm not going to say an equal measure, but then there were the other kinds where you hit a ball. Wow. That's really carrying. That's really, oh my gosh, it's over the fence. So statistically speaking, it was always a better park to pitch in, but not as extreme as the park the Giants play in now, but not as extreme as it was in the popular imagination.
Okay. All right.
So you have now, it's 1989, and you have this ballpark. It's always the worst ballpark in the major leagues by any ranking that you'll do. Sporting News does one every year. It's always 30th. You know, towards the end, maybe you get Montreal in there as the 30th. But the Giants, this is the dump to end all dumps. And really what changes it, and it's hard to – have you ever seen that meme where you've got someone setting a domino And then it goes like 40 dominoes back, and it's something like, you know, Obama picks his nose, and then the big one is the world ends. And the idea is that, you know, one little butterfly flapping its wings, clink, 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 clink. But there's a lot of speculation that the earthquake is really where it turned around for San Francisco, because it damaged the freeway that ran along the waterfront so much they had to tear it down and turn it into housing.
The Embarcadero,
a beautiful part of the city. And so now you've got, okay, so the earthquake is helping San Francisco in a really, really weird roundabout way. But that's also one of the things that Candlestick is known for, because that's when it happened, the world was watching the World Series. You've got World Series Game 2. Everyone is watching it. And it's at Candlestick Park. And that, I think, to a lot of people, if they're not of the age to remember the Beatles doing the concert at Candlestick Park, that's the lasting image of Candlestick Park, is Al Michaels talking and then everything shaking behind it.
Wow. You know, I was in Spain when that happened, and it was at a time when you couldn't, in order to make a phone call from Europe to the United States, you had to go into a shop, like a state-run shop, take a number, tell them where you were going to call, wait for them to call your number, and then they would dial it for you, and you would go sit in a booth and like, hello? And we heard that there'd been a devastating earthquake in San Francisco and that the Bay Bridge had collapsed. Yeah. And I was traveling with a guy from San Francisco, and we were just marveling. This was the big one. If the Bay Bridge collapsed, the entire city of San Francisco must be in flames. And we were thinking, we have to get back there. Can you even get back there? And then it took a day or two for the International Herald Tribune to report on it. And it was like, oh, it was an earthquake, but it's not like the Bay Bridge was down, like a like a deck collapsed. But I didn't realize that the World Series was happening and that it was televised. How did I not know that?
Yeah, if you look up on YouTube, it's a super famous clip in baseball lore where it's just they're talking and they're showing a play from game one of the World Series, and then and the World Series was postponed for 2 weeks while San Francisco reacted to the earthquake. One thing that I constantly think about, it's just one of the things I can't get into my head, is that other than the section of the Bay Bridge that collapsed, one of the big problem spots was the Cypress Structure, which is the stretch of freeway, Oakland, East Bay. And that collapsed. And the number of passengers, the number of people traveling on it were so much lower than normal because it was the A's and the Giants in the World Series.
So it would have pancaked hundreds, but there's nobody there.
Yeah, it's thousands. I mean, it's just that the world kind of shut, or San Francisco, Oakland shut down for that World Series. It's a big deal. You got the A's versus the Giants. Area loves it when that sort of thing happens. So without that, yeah, who knows what the toll would have been.
Wow.
Candlestick Park, it was too beautiful for this world. My too beautiful is awful. It really was bad. I grew up there. I was a vendor there. I sold Cracker Jack. I sold water there. I sold programs for the 49ers every so often.
As a teenager?
Yeah. I came home from college in 1998 and was just out there hawking the Cracker Jacks.
Wow. That's a thing that you don't see as much anymore. When you go to a baseball game, I'm always like, shouldn't there be somebody selling hot dogs? Hey, and I don't know what happened to all the vendors.
It was, so this was in the 90s, the Giants weren't drawing very well. They never drew very well in Candlestick for all the obvious reasons that I've been talking about. But especially on the weeknights, you would get a team that wasn't very good in. You would just get this bad team. It'd be a Tuesday night and you'd have 2,000 people in the stands. You can ask all of 2,000 people if they want some Cracker Jacks within 10 minutes. Baseball games are famously not 10 minutes. So my job was just to go around repeatedly. And I'm surprised someone just didn't flip out on me and say, no, no Cracker Jacks. No, never. But I made a 17% commission. Oh. Yeah, minus union dues.
And so when did the wave of steroids make baseball in San Francisco bananas.
Well, that's jumping a little bit ahead because you've got what happens now is the Giants are gone. They're going to move. Candlestick is such a dump. The city won't approve any new ballparks. They got to go. They're sold to a team in Tampa Bay or a consortium of prospective owners in Tampa Bay. They're going to move to Tropicana Field as we know it now, which is still there. And it's done. It's a done deal. The league has signed off on it. A group of local San Francisco businessmen, spearheaded by the CEO, one-time CEO of Safeway, just said, no, this is San Francisco. I grew up watching Willie Mays, Willie McCovey. And obviously, it wasn't purely altruistic. You know, there's going to be, they did very well for themselves. But there really was more of a sense of, no, we have to keep this team here than you might expect from a group of local businessmen. It was really, nope, let's buy the team. They bought the team, and then they bought the best player, Barry Bonds, who was the son of a Giants legend, godson of Willie Mays, and eventually would do all the steroids that you're talking about. But it was a way to say, nope, team's staying here. We have bought it. We're going to get you a new ballpark, and here's the best player in baseball to boot. And that's kind of when the team's fortunes flipped around.
But did that improve the fortunes of Candlestick Park?
It did not. Candlestick Park is no more because they eventually did build a beautiful ballpark. It is, I'm biased, but I think it's the best ballpark in all of sports, not just baseball. It sits on the bay. They had these things called computers, which could predict how the wind goes. And so the direction it's facing, originally they wanted it facing towards the city for the skyline, but the computer said, nope, that's windy, face the bay. And so now it's a bay-facing stadium with a remarkable wind-breaking abilities.
And close to town. It's not out in the middle of a swamp. It's
train goes right there. I mean, it is everything that we were jealous of about the A's ballpark before that crumbled.
And they've also built an entire town around it, right? I mean, isn't that a big area of housing now and business?
Absolutely. Yeah. The Warriors are down there now. A lot of the real estate in that area, it was nothing. Now it's built up to some mixed use housing. The San Francisco Giants actually own a lot of it, developed a lot of it. That's a big thing with baseball teams now. It's not just enough to run a baseball team. You got to have a little real estate on the side. So the Giants are on that train too.
What did the destruction of Candlestick Park look like?
You know, it was piece by piece. It was not something that happened overnight. It wasn't, you'll see, I think the King Dome was one of the famous ones that you got to see implode, right?
We went out and boy, we were all standing on a bridge, the 12th Avenue Bridge, that looks right out on the whole King Dome panorama, and watched that thing blow up and the subsequent huge cloud of concrete dust and, you know, and explosive debris blow throughout the city. It was just a huge a giant cloud. And the wind just took it throughout the town. It was beautiful. We were standing in the perfect vantage point, but a real moment.
Yeah, no, I wish that they had done something like that with Candlestick. It was a lot more boring. It was this piece down, this piece down. They did, however, keep the seats. And they sold the seats. And so in my backyard, I have a pair of orange Candlestick seats in my backyard.
Well, this has been a fascinating entry in the omnibus. It feels kind of like the Penn Station story a little bit, which we've never told. But kind of the Penn Station story still evolving. Madison Square Garden continues to be the worst place. And Penn Station, the worst place ever, literally the worst place. But it feels like Giant Stadium was the worst place, and now it's ceded what would have been second place, and now Madison Square Gardens and Penn Station gets to be the worst place, and thank goodness.
Yeah, and I did forget a postscript with our friend Charles Harney. At one point, he had painted Harney Stadium on the side of the truck. He would refer to it as Harney Stadium when he was in front of the Board of Supervisors. And he had it in his head that it was going to be called Harney Stadium. And wow. When they decided it was going to be Candlestick, he, in a later retelling, just quit. Just said, nope, you build the ballpark then. Not for me. And later when they were doing renovations in the 80s, maybe the 90s, they found a little apartment that he had put hidden away in Candlestick Park. It was going to be his love nest, his little, well, I don't want to presume. I don't want to, maybe right, his, right, reading sure, nook, sure. His reading sure. nook, his reading nook. But he, a little apartment in Candlestick Park, never used. They said it. He never saw a game there.
Wow. And why was it called Candlestick? We never got to the name.
It's the geography of the place. It was called Candlestick Point. And I think if you look at the actual, you know, shape of the land, and you get a little, it kind of looks like one of those things that you carry with a sleeping cap. And, you know, before you say honk shoe, you know, one of those candlestick type things.
Well, that concludes Candlestick Park. Entry 179.EX3937, certificate number 31484, in the omnibus. Grant, even though our episode has gone long, you are the first show where I have actually received mail to our new PO box. So as I read the outro, stick around, and I'm going to open some mail with you.
Please.
Futurelings, as we all know and as we've oft repeated, social media is terrible. It's the Candlestick Park of our time, a thing that was built by maniac contractors at great expense, and it robs us every day. There's a cold wind blowing through it. Stay away from it. But if you insist on congregating there, you can find other futurelings, one of the only nice places on the internet, talking to other futurelings on Facebook, which is a terrible place, on Reddit, which is an awful, awful place, and on Discord, which I don't even understand well enough to know whether it's a good place or not.
No idea.
Who knows? People are playing video games on there, but they're also talking about Omnibus. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, which is where to email us if you are wanting to, I don't know, congratulate us, dispute something, talk about your relationship. I'll cover all of that when I read your emails in the Addenda Show. And the Addenda Show you can listen to by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject. There are years and years kind of shows where we read emails, me and our friend and former co-host Ken Jennings would read your emails and respond to them. Turns out Ken was really condensing those emails. Now that I'm reading them, many of them are paragraphs and paragraphs long, and Ken always made them seem like they were concise little, but I think he was only reading the first two sentences. He didn't get into any of the...
No, big red pen. Get to the point, Ken. Yep, get to the point.
He was scanning them like, yeah. But you can email us there at theomnibusproject@gmail.com and send physical mail to The Omnibus Project, 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084. Burien, Washington, that's B-U-R-I-E-N, 98166. And so I went to the P.O. box the other day. I got a Burien magazine.
Oh, okay.
Which is a magazine about Burien that I've never seen before. And I haven't opened it yet because I wanted to do it here on camera. It seems like, yeah, it's the kind of thing that even free, you wouldn't want. But here, look at this. It's a box. It's a fairly large box, big enough that it didn't fit in the PO box, and so the post office put it in a separate box.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how mad are people in Burien going to be that I had to Google Burien?
Oh, not at all. A lot of people in Seattle didn't know anything about Burien. And one of those people was me. I didn't know anything about Burien until I got to be a little bit older. And, you know, as you get to be an older person, the suburbs start to sound interesting. And then you realize, oh, I can't even afford to live in the suburbs. But Burien,
is the suburb to the south where you could continue, you still even to this day can find affordable housing.
The great unclaimed frontier.
Yeah, that's right. All right, the box contains the 1968 Encyclopedia Yearbook.
Okay.
1968 being, as many futurelings know, the year that I was born. And inside there's a letter. Dear John, I hope this letter finds you in good health and stead. As I write this, the weather in Atlanta is cold and rainy.
Okay, better than hot and sticky.
Yeah, but that's right. The two options you have in Atlanta, hot and sticky, cold and rainy. But this echoes the theme of today's show. Let's see. Cold and rainy, as it is perhaps in Seattle when you read this. I regret that I did not have more presentable parchment on which to write. Seems like a page from a Moleskine. As it has been many years since I have had any written correspondence with anyone. Your penmanship is phenomenal, though. But it's printed. You know, the penmanship is like...
Oh, it's... Yeah, look at that.
It's nice handwriting, but printed. It's
delightful.
It has been so long, in fact, that this is coming out as rather formal. If it were not for my Gen X contrarianism, I would add an emoji on here to lighten the tone. In any case, I trust that, you know, her grammar, and I recognize that our writer is a woman by many clues in the printing, but her grammar and language is, although formal, very good. In any case, I trust that you will gain some enjoyment from this yearbook. I have already skimmed its pages for $100 bills and savored the smell of aged paper and bookstore dust. It is a quality binding. May we age as well as if. With great affection, Christine. Nailed Thank it. You, Christine.
That is, well, what part of 1968 was that released?
Well, so this is the Encyclopedia Yearbook, which I think means it was released in 1969.
But which part of 1969? Because if it's like in the beginning, it's not as updated as one that was released in the second half of 1969. There was probably more information coming in.
That's right. Well, this says copyright 1968, so they must have raced it out. There was a lot going on in 1968. Oh, wait. They're talking about a lot of things that happened in 1967.
So they're doing like a new car. They're doing it 1 year in the future.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, right. All the dates in here are 1967. So this is the world into which I was born rather than reflecting the world as I affected it once I arrived.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all of our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in The Omnibus.